Hello and welcome to Hysteria. I'm Alyssa Mastromonaco.
And I'm Erin Haynes.
That's right. The next in our summer lineup of co-hosts is another fabulous Erin, but this one's spelled with two R's, and she's the editor-at-large for the 19th News. She's the host of their podcast, The Amendment, and she writes a bi-weekly newsletter with the same name. So, Erin, now that we have you here, I need to ask you a very important question. It's being covered by CNN, USA Today, Fox News, The Guardian, Men's Health, NBC.
What are we talking about?
No, I'm not talking about the Justin Timberlake DWI.
Also following.
Are you following the hot rodent men trend?
Sadly, yes, I've fallen down this rabbit hole. Yes.
How can you not?
Indeed. How can you not?
So, Erin, people are just saying that the hottest men right now resemble various rodents.
What does that say about us as a society? Is that where we are?
I'm not sure, but here's the thing. At first, I was like, this is nonsense. But then they're like, Timothée Chalamet, a mouse. And I was like, shit, he is very adorable and a mouse.
We will never look at them the same again. Adam Driver, I mean, I thought he was hot, but I was not associating his hotness with any sort of rodent qualities. And I don't want to. And now I can't go back because this has been put out into the universe for me. So thanks. Thanks, media. Thank you, media.
On this week's Hysteria, I interview Disha Dyer to talk about her new book, Undiplomatic, and the perils of imposter syndrome. Erin Haynes joins to talk about what the 19th News has been reporting on, and she gets real petty about the narrative around black voters allegedly running to Trump. Welcome back to Hysteria, the podcast for fans of the 19th Amendment.
Exactly.
Okay. So listen, in case you missed it, listeners, little more SCOTUS news on Mifepristone. So there was big breaking news that, of course, dropped after we recorded our episode last week, and I want to run through a little bit. First, we can't help but be a little suspicious over the fact that SCOTUS last Thursday unanimously voted to dismiss the lawsuit that sought to limit access to Mifepristone, a very common and safe abortion drug used in almost two-thirds of abortions in the U.S. In case you forgot, the case, also known as the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine versus the FDA, saw the plaintiff challenging the legal standing of the FDA to expand access to Mifepristone. So, Erin, what does this mean? Is Samuel Alito now all of a sudden a pro-choice warrior?
Let's not get crazy, Alyssa.
Okay, just want to make sure.
No. I mean, by no means is this kind of unanimous decision somehow an endorsement of protection of abortion care by this Supreme Court. I think what the takeaway here for us needs to be is that this is not them necessarily saying Mifepristone is cool, right? I definitely don't think that's the takeaway here. But I think that what the court was saying was that, these plaintiffs here just did not have standing. I mean, according to Vox, the court's decision was pretty narrow. That opinion was really much more concerned with the nature of the lawsuit that was brought to the court versus the actual substance of the argument, right? So the plaintiffs, the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine was not really able to show how they were personally injured by the FDA, right, in this case. So what I think, you know, SCOTUS may be kind of signaling to, folks who are, you know, maybe looking to get rid of Mifepristone, go back to the drawing board, right?
But get a better case.
Absolutely. But by no means should this be interpreted as like some kind of sign that SCOTUS is somehow softening on restrictions to reproductive care.
Right. And we still have more opinions to hear before the end of June.
It's a sprint to the finish.
It is a sprint to the finish. And while this one also for people who are online being like, maybe this is good news for the EMTALA case, I would not conflate anything.
Sure. And Mifepristone safe for now. But that's not to say that we will not see another Mifepristone case before this court at some point.
Oh, yikes. Okay. Also last week, weird shit going on in Arkansas. So Sam B and I, as we were getting on the air last week, we talked a little bit about the intimidation tactics currently being used by anti-abortion activists in Arkansas to ultimately try and prevent a state abortion amendment from making the ballot box. Now, I want to dive a little deeper. Last week, we kind of like knew it happened, but we didn't know much more. So the 19th talked about how this Arkansas issue highlights the broader safety risks for abortion organizers throughout the country, organizers who are mostly women.
Yeah.
As a refresher, according to the 19th, this measure would amend the state constitution to prohibit laws or policies restricting abortion access within 18 weeks from conception, or in the cases of rape, incest, or fatal fetal anomaly, or when abortion is needed to protect the life or health of the mother. So, Aaron, what is the 19th's new reporting on this? What's happening in Arkansas and to the activists?
Well, Alyssa, thank you so much for highlighting our reporting. That's from Barbara Rodriguez, who really is monitoring a lot of what is happening on the ground in Arkansas. You know, I think what this really highlights is the broader issue of what it means for women in this moment to really be participating in our politics, and how political violence, threats of intimidation, harassment, or worse, are really sadly becoming part of what comes with trying to participate in our democracy. I think about even, you know, Ruby Freeman and Shea Moss, those poll workers.
Yep,
we know the threat to poll workers already, and now we're learning that these organizers for this abortion ballot measure in Arkansas are facing similar threats. So, you know, according to our reporting, you know, one woman said she'd been called a murderer at public events, and another woman said she was followed by a protester, by a protester from location to location. And then a third just really stopped posting publicly about her real-time whereabouts because she was concerned about her safety. So this is something that organizers are saying has been escalating, especially in the last, like, 4 to 6 weeks. And we know that these abortion ballot measures have been successful when they have been able to get on the ballot and been put in front of voters. So, you know, to the extent that folks do not want these abortion ballot measures to happen, certainly, you know, threats of an act, you know, political intimidation is a means, you know, part of the strategy now to try to prevent these ballot initiatives from getting on the ballot. And that it's just really unfortunate and says a lot, I think, about where our politics are today. And it's important to pay attention to what's happening in Arkansas right now.
It is important to pay attention to what's happening in Arkansas. And also, it makes me think about, like, how people of a specific party or a specific position, in this case, the anti-abortion activists, the will of the people doesn't mean anything to them. Like, why wouldn't you want it on the ballot?
Yeah.
Go ahead and organize your people. Get them out to vote. Vote it down.
Yeah.
But the fact that now, when people don't get their way, like, to me, it is just a shocking thing to think about. If 70% of the people in my community voted for something, I think kind of no matter what it was, I'd be like, all right, well, this is where I live and this is what the people wanted. Yeah. But they, I mean, like, Ohio is a great example of it passing constitutional amendment. And now every elected official who is a Republican in Ohio is trying to be like, well, there are exceptions, or this is not exactly what it meant to try to, you know, make abortion and reproductive rights like a fundamental right of women in Ohio. And it's like, dude, it passed by like 57%.
And just because, I mean, folks not liking the outcome or trying to prevent a certain outcome, it shouldn't mean that everything is on the table to try, you know, as a means to preventing that outcome. I mean, like, it really speaks to, you know, a question of whether, you know, we're going to have respect for the democratic process,
quality
democratic process, right? Like, whatever that is, however that plays out, you know, trying to influence that, especially by intimidating or harassing people and in a way that's gendered, that's not cool.
No. And, you know, it's like this is a trite story, but I have to share it. Back in 2004, when I was working on the Kerry campaign and we lost famously 2004 to George Bush, I got home to Washington, D.C. I had been in Boston, and I come home and someone had hit my car.
Oh,
right. My car, the headlights are smashed in.
Insult to injury.
Oh, so someone leaves a note and they're like, hey, I hit your car. Here's my number. So I go to call the number, and the voicemail I get is, hi, I'm celebrating another 4 years of George Bush. Leave a message. And I was like, you know what? I don't want her money. Like, I just, go do you. You know, I just kind of wish that we could do a little bit more of that, I guess. Not like I'm some fucking hero, but, like, I don't know. I just feel like if democracy ebbs and flows, but, like, if we don't actually respect the outcomes of our democracy, it feels like we're in a lot of trouble.
Do better. Do
better.
That's all I got.
Speaking of doing better, oh, lordy. Okay, so you remember earlier this year when Alabama banned IVF?
Oh, yeah.
And the conservatives like Katie Britt and Ted Cruz, they were kind of like, record scratch might have gone too far, and they made feeble attempts to try to protect IVF. Yeah. Well, that's all gone to shit. True colors coming out. Last week, Senate Republicans blocked legislation that would make IVF and other fertility treatments a right nationwide. Now, what I think is particularly grotesque is the sponsor of the bill was Tammy Duckworth, who, of course, she used IVF. And I feel like if you're a Republican senator, that's some real fucking dark shit inside your soul to be like, actually, veteran, American hero, mom, I'm going to vote your shit down. But the bill would have expanded access through insurance, giving military members and vets better access. Senator Schumer forced the vote to get Republicans on the record on reproductive care in an election year, which I appreciate. Now, the vote was mostly for show, but the implications are pretty real. So, Aaron, simultaneous to this happening, a story that I don't think got enough coverage but is meaningful, one of the country's most influential conservative political groups, the Southern Baptist Church, yeah, voted to oppose IVF. The church boasts 13 million members across the country. Yeah. So, Aaron, I have many questions for you.
Yeah, we need
on
to unpack this.
This.
It's a lot to unpack.
Let's get into it. How big a deal? A lot of people are looking at this. They're like, okay, so fucking church voted. Who cares? What? How big a deal is the vote by the Southern Baptists?
Yeah, okay, so it is a big deal. I mean, look, right, the Southern Baptists are not making law, but certainly what they say holds a lot of sway with their members, right?
Right.
And we certainly reported on this at the 19th because it was such a big deal. I mean, honestly, we thought maybe the big news out of, you know, coming out of that Southern Baptist convention was going to be, you know, whether or not they were going to allow women pastors,
right,
or, you know, what, you know, former President Trump was going to say addressing them. By the way, he had some comments around abortion, you know, understanding who his audience was. So,
yep.
Anyway, so according to our reporting, the resolution cites the number of embryos generated in the IVF process, resulting in freezing, stockpiling, and sometimes destroying the excess, and asks families to use other reproductive technologies or to consider adopting children or unwanted frozen embryos. Also, today I learned, you know, that you could adopt frozen embryos. I did not know that.
Who knew?
I did not know that. But, you know, certainly there are folks who are in this church who are wrestling with this issue, right?
Right.
Who, you know, and who may be looking for guidance from their church in terms of mm-hmm, what to do if they are wrestling with this. I mean, they said in their, the church said, you know, we grieve alongside couples who have been diagnosed with infertility or who are currently struggling to conceive and affirm their godly desire for children. And yet they still say, you know, that IVF, that they're opposed to IVF. So it is a pretty big deal. Although, like I said, I mean, it's not binding in terms of telling people what
right,
they can or can't do.
But here's another question. Why would Southern Baptists want to ban IVF?
You know, I think this does bring up the reminder that abortion is not just a political, I mean, it has been politicized, right? But that
right,
for many people, this is a question of faith. And, mm-hmm, you know, to the extent that folks are, you know, that they stand against abortion, mm-hmm, if they see, you know, these embryos as life, then, you know, I can see how they end up getting here.
Right.
You know, even as this is also a pathway to life for a lot of families that don't have another option.
Mm-hmm. And here's the thing. So much like everything that's happening, like the vote in the Senate last week, this is not an isolated fringe issue. And for so many people, whether on social media or on the news, who say Biden's old, Trump's old, it doesn't matter who's president. Like it's, you know, so Trump's going to cut taxes, whatever. No, this is all straight out of the Project 2025 playbook, which for anyone who doesn't know, we've definitely talked about the Federalist Society on this podcast before, who are equally nefarious. Project 2025 is a well-funded, they've got like a $22 million budget, organization with a 900-page blueprint for a possible new Trump administration. And we know that he is not creative, and all the people who he wants to work in his administration are abiding this blueprint. They want to be as destructive as possible if Trump becomes president. And the BBC describes Project 2025 as an effort to, quote, restore the family as the centerpiece of American life, dismantle the administrative state, defend the nation's sovereignty and borders, and secure God-given individuals' rights to live freely. Now, Aaron, that doesn't sound terrible, I guess. Doesn't sound that terrible. But why should we all be afraid of 2025? Let's get into what the fuck they're really talking about here.
I mean, this is a plan that is going to make certain people in this country less free, less equal. And so, you know, and they've already put it out here, you know, months before this election, what the plan is should... you know, presumptive Republican nominee Donald Trump become president again, like that this this is very much the, you know, his agenda. You know, I think we probably will hear more about this at the Republican convention later on this summer.
Sure.
But whether we're talking about abortion, you know, they don't call for a nationwide abortion ban, but certainly they're all about possibly withdrawing mifepristone from the market. Whether we're talking about government. They want to bring DOJ under, you know, direct presidential control. That is not
unitary executive theory.
Not the way that this,
which
not the way democracy
Trump
works.
A king. Not it's the way, making him a king.
That's not the way democracy works, right? Immigration, you know, once again, the wall is back in play. You know, that's proposed in this document. Climate, progress on climate out the window under this. And obviously, I mean, we just had a story in the 19th that was talking about, you know, how this applies to trans rights, which would be threatened. Yeah.
This, so I want to talk more about the trans rights, but other things to just float to float and flag for listeners. So this is something that's very deep in my DNA. Trump wants to get rid of everybody that he refers to as the deep state. Those people are actually the people responsible for the continuity of government. They are what stabilizes the career employees, Schedule F employees. They're what stabilizes the government and makes the peaceful transition of power a thing. Like, they are the people who, they are the nuts and bolts of the government. And he, as part of this, wants to be able to just, like, eliminate their job protections. He's like, you know what? I've had enough of you. I want to get rid of you. And I want to be clear. I actually was like, I'm not sure he can do that. How can he do that? There is actually something called the Presidential Reorganization Act, which gives him the power to do things like that. And also, another one of the things that he's talked about, eliminating the Department of Education.
Right.
Which many of the people either on his short list or on his list of, like, potential cabinet secretaries all fucking agree with. Vivek Ramaswamy, Ron DeSantis, they're all like, yeah, well, let's just fucking get rid of that shit. Why not?
That's long been discussed, but it seems like it would be a probability, right? If he were to get back into office. Yeah.
And so Project 2025 also highlights the right's hatred for trans people, as you mentioned. So the 19th did some reporting on this. And you guys talked to LGBTQ plus activists who are fighting back against the things that Project 2025 stands for, which include preventing Medicare and Medicaid funding from reaching hospitals that provide gender-affirming care to trans kids, charge teachers with sex discrimination if they validate kids' gender identities. This is another one. Order federal agencies to stop programs that promote the concept of sex and gender transition at any age. So, Aaron, what did the 19th find out about how these activists are fighting back against us?
Yeah, I mean, thank you again for highlighting this story because, you know, there are a lot of people, you know, a lot of voters. It's summertime. You know, the election is five-ish months away. People may not necessarily be paying attention to every single thing that's going on. And there are a lot of people that, frankly, are not aware of Project 2025 or what is in it or who, you know, it could potentially impact. And so, you know, a lot of these activists are absolutely paying attention and they are really taking this seriously and are trying to act with a sense of urgency to respond in case the outcome of the election is that former President Trump is elected and Project 2025 is implemented. So, you know, what does that mean? It's important for us at the 19th, especially because we are not like both sides in people's dignity or humanity.
Correct.
To really talk about the people that are pushing back against efforts to make people less free and less equal in our democracy. And so what does that mean? Showing, you know, what these LGBTQ plus activists are doing, getting trans people out to vote. It means developing relationships with members of Congress who might support trans people, right? Because that could possibly impact policy. It means starting to talk to states, because so much of the attack on trans people in this country, we've already seen happening at the state level. So trying to prepare states who might have to start protecting trans constituents to the extent that they can on a more local level. And then also, you know, after the laws come the lawsuits. So, you know, preparing to get litigious, even if, you know, Trump wins and does start kind of enacting some of these policies.
God bless. I mean, look, there's a little good news out of the Sunshine State. A federal judge in Florida ruled that gender-affirming care restrictions for both minors and adults are unconstitutional.
Yeah.
Thank God. Transgender healthcare is officially back in the Sunshine State, the first state in the U.S. that pushed to restrict access to care. So again, like anything that we see, it's like, yes, that's good news, but you still can't take your foot off the gas because they're not stopping with their 2025 agenda.
Well, forget 2025. This obviously, a lot of this is very much underway right now,
right?
Even with Republicans out of power in the White House, at this moment, or you know, not necessarily having full control of Congress, there's still a lot of activity happening at the state level and on all fronts, right? Like in state houses, even, you know, at the local government level, and also obviously in our legal system. So continuing to stay on top of this is really important to us at the 19th. And we're going to certainly continue to watch this Project 2025 conversation, but also, you know, kind of overall what is happening with attacks on transgender folks in this country.
Yes. And listeners, if you want to hear more about LGBTQ plus rights as a crucial progressive voting issue, listen to the last episode of Erin's podcast, The Amendment, where she talked to the president of the Human Rights Campaign, Kelly Robinson. Can't recommend it enough. Thank it was a great interview. We'll be talking more about the state of trans rights next week to close out Pride Month. So stay tuned. Okay. I think we have one more news story.
A lot of news going on.
There was so much news, but I can't get enough of you. So I need to cover all of it with you. So last week, I can't wait to hear you talk about this. Last week, Vice President Kamala Harris, who you were the first person to interview her as vice president, right?
Yeah. I think I have the record for most interviews with her, but who's counting?
I'm counting.
Oh, okay.
Because I love it and I wanted to talk about it. So VP Harris announced that the Biden administration is trying to enact a federal rule that would ban medical debt from credit reports. Yeah. Now, you and I were both like, holy shit, this is a big deal.
Yeah.
Again, with all the stupid news that we watch on television and is in our feeds, a lot of things like this get overlooked. So reporting, again, from the 19th, shows that this would make applying for a car, home, or business loans much easier for Americans with this type of debt. As a data point, according to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, known as CFPB, a March 2022 study found that 20 million Americans were harboring $88 billion in medical debt. Erin, banning medical debt from credit reports seems like an extremely good and correct thing to do. Who would this impact most?
Yeah, I mean, I think, surprise, surprise, women, people of color, people with disabilities, people living in low-income communities, like these are the people that are most burdened with medical debt. And so these are the people that would most be helped by this rule. I think that there was one study that was administered by Undue Medical Debt. 27% of surveyed Black women said that they delayed or refused health care because they were scared of collecting medical debt. And don't forget,
right.
I mean, you compound this, say you compound this with the Black women who, disproportionately carry the most student loan debt, right? I mean, this is keeping people back. You talk about the wealth gap. This is literally impacting folks in terms of race and gender, you know, in addition to other things, that intersectional issues that are impacting their lives. This medical debt, I think, could be even more impactful than the student debt relief that has happened so far.
I agree. It affects so many people and stops them from so many things that, like, even this is a very small example, but many years ago, I had to go to, I worked at a company that didn't believe in letting you take bathroom breaks. Mm. And so I ended up with a kidney infection, which landed me in the ER. Yes. And I had insurance, but that bill was like $2,500. Yeah. And I was, I think at the time my salary was $22,500 a year. And so I wasn't paying it. I was just like, I'll get to this someday. Wow. Right. Like I'll get to it. And then I got into a car accident and had to get a new car. And I was denied. I found a used car for $5,000 and I was denied a loan. And I was like, how's that possible? And then I looked at my credit score.
And it was the medical debt.
And it was, there were two things that affected me, but the medical debt was key.
Wow.
Key. And I was like, oh my God, well, to pay off the medical debt now, I really can't get a car. Like, what am I going
right.
to do?
Because if you pay off the medical debt, how are you going to have the money for the car?
And how am I going to get around and do things without a car? Now, I am a lucky person. I had to figure it out, but like, this is a real thing and I want to highlight it. And there's also one other thing in researching this that I found out that I did not know existed. So there was another federal effort to curb medical debt. One included the No Surprises Act, which took effect in July 2022. And it requires private health insurers to cover most emergency services, emergency care, and non-emergency in-network services, and prohibits medical providers from billing patients more than in-network cost sharing. Now, I did not know this existed. And I have seen so many stories, specifically, we both love Gayle King. Gayle's yeah. always doing it on CBS Morning, where they do a story about someone who's getting fleeced by the insurance system to try to like smoke them out and make them take care of it. And this is like a real thing. Like Aaron Ryan and I have talked about, like, if you ever have to go to the emergency, should we just have emergency t-shirts that say, are you in my network?
Yeah.
So that if something happens and we have to go to the emergency room and we don't have the function of like what's happening yeah. on the plat, like what's happening to us in that moment, to be like, hold on, before you treat me, are you in my network?
And see, and this is exactly why I say that this, I think this will be more impactful than the student debt relief, because I mean, people opt into going to college, you know,
yes.
maybe they don't intentionally sign up for as much student loan debt
totally.
As they're getting. I totally get that. I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is that people don't have control over a medical emergency happening to them.
No.
People don't, you know, if there's a medical event that happens to you that is not your fault, and then you get this huge medical debt as a result. And look, you said $4,400, the average mm-hmm. you know, amount of medical debt that people are, that's a lot of money. That's
a
lot of money for the average American. So, I mean, you know, it may not seem like a lot of money to some people that have money, but if you don't have money, $4,400 is going to create a lot more problems for you besides that medical event that you had. But like in 2022, there was a YouGov poll that reported that, mm-hmm. that like 66% of Americans support government relief for medical debt. So like, we know this is something
yes.
that is popular with the American people. People have already tried to take action at the state level. You know, in recent years, Texas and Kentucky showed interest in erasing residents' medical debt there. In June of last year, Colorado becomes the first state to prohibit medical debt from being included on residents' credit reports.
Yep.
Similar legislation got passed this year in Connecticut, proposed in New Jersey. You know, earlier this year, Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs, who is a Democrat, yep. announced efforts to use $30 million of funding to cancel medical debt for up to 1 million Arizonans. So, I mean, you know, I they're taking public comments on this medical debt yep. proposal now at the federal level. They're going to be accepted through August 12th. So if people, you know, have feelings about that, they should contribute to those public comments. But they expect yep. this rule to be finalized early next year. So hopefully that will provide some relief to some people really, really, you know, in the coming year.
Fingers crossed.
That's a Project 2025 that we can get behind.
Yes, that's our Project 2025. Okay, so coming up, my conversation with Obama's former White House Social Secretary and my dear friend, Disha Dyer.
Hi, my name is Mitch Landrieu.
My name is Erin Haynes.
My name is Jennifer Palmieri, and we're hosting a new series called Long Play. The South is the new political epicenter of the country. Democrats are way on their heels in this region, but Republicans are going through their own reckoning in the South, too.
I mean, the South has always shaped American politics. We know that.
The stakes could not be higher, but to win the South, you have to understand it.
People in the South feel really misunderstood, left behind, put down on, and they want to explain that to somebody.
We're traveling across 6 southern states to explore the people, the issues, the assumptions that no longer hold, and what the rest of us are missing about a region that will shape the future of our politics and our country. From Left, Right, and Crooked Media, starting July 27th, watch Long Play Series on YouTube at youtube.com/longplayseries or listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Hysteria, the podcast for the girlies fighting imposter syndrome. Today's guest was formerly the White House Social Secretary for the Obama administration and a Harvard Kennedy School Fellow. Now she's the CEO of Hook and Fasten, a social impact firm, and the author of the best-selling book, Undiplomatic, How My Attitude Created the Best Kind of Trouble. Please welcome Deesha Dyer.
I am so excited to be here. Hi, Alyssa. Hi, everyone.
Deesh. Okay, first, I've been so excited to have you on.
Yes.
I got to ask about the book.
Yes.
Undiplomatic came out a few weeks ago. How's the release been going?
It's actually been going great. I mean, it's, you know, a combination of like panic and exhaustion and excitement and fear and like, it's all the things. And I think that, you know, the reception has been way better than what I thought it was going to be, especially like in our political climate. I was waiting for like MAGA weirdos to like come out the woodwork, right? But it's been like super received by so many people. And I'm so thankful that people are like, this book is very messy and it's a reflection of my life. I'm like, exactly. So I'm happy that it's like really hitting with people. So that's great.
Well, I want to level set for the audience because we aren't just colleagues from the White House. We have a special relationship. We have known each other since the day you decided to apply to be a 30-year-old intern in the White House, which is a thing. And I want to flag it because most interns, most people who decide to intern are like 19 or in their early 20s. So, Deesh, can you tell the story of how you went from a hip-hop reporter and community college student to working in the White House?
Yes. I mean, I can't believe it's been that long. It's been like 15 years, which is nuts. So I dropped out of college the first time and I was like 17. I wasn't feeling it. Wasn't my thing. I was broke. And I decided to kind of just like follow the things I love to do that made me curious. I was like, I'm going to just get jobs at the mall and then like start writing about hip hop because women were so underrepresented in the hip hop culture as far as just like producers and breakdancers and, you know, beatboxers. And so I was like, I'm going to write about women in hip hop. And so I started doing that, which led to this, you know, amazing career being a freelancer for a number of years. I was always a community advocate, started with HIV/AIDS with Ryan White in the 90s. So I always like kept one foot in community. And then like around 2007, when I decided to go back to college, to Community College of Philadelphia, the only college that would accept me, Barack Obama started, you know, he started appearing on my screen. And I was like, who is this like rando person that's on my screen, like running for president? And he's so charismatic. He's like saying things that I actually like pay attention to versus other politicians. I'd be like, not interested. I don't even know who this person is. And he was Black. So that was like obviously a plus. And I just started like following the campaign, but I didn't know anybody. Like I didn't know how I can get involved. I was too broke to donate. I didn't have any time. So I had all these jobs and I was going to school. And then I got an application for a White House internship. And I was like, well, what is this? Like, I was kind of like, what is an internship? And like, the first thing it said was unpaid. And I was like, I'm sorry. Like, I can't afford this. But I was like, you know what? The application doesn't cost anything. So I'm just going to put the application in, see what happens. And I got it because someone sent it to me and was like, did you mentor all these young people in the community? You should send this to them. And I was like, I'm not sending it because they're a competition. So I'm just going to apply myself.
Right.
And got the position in scheduling in advance, which you were the leader at the time. So that was that.
So you know what the thing was, Deesh, is that, and I feel like you employ this too. I am not someone who's like very pedigreed educationally. Mm-hmm. I went to public school, worked my ass off when I left, didn't get the jobs I wanted when I graduated. Mm-hmm. And so when I saw your application, I was like, she fucking wants to do this. Like, yes. Why would we say no? And so you came, which is not the story for most people. You were so fucking competent. You were such a, and you know what the thing about it is that, and I kind of feel like I learned this from Barack Obama and I saw it in you. He was like a deeply curious person.
Yeah.
Right. And so like whenever I meet someone, I'm like, I'm curious. Like, I was curious about you. I'm like, hip-hop reporter?
Yes.
She's fucking doing this? Like, yes. And for me, even now to this day, when confronted with someone who I don't agree with, I definitely lead with curiosity and try to figure out more about the person than just being like, oh, I think you might be a bad person.
Right.
Like, that's just not the point.
No.
And so you came to the White House and my deputy, my esteemed beloved deputy, Danielle Crutchfield.
We love,
I was like, how's Deesh doing? And she was just like, she's fucking killing it. And so you were not an intern for very long.
No.
You got hired quickly.
Yes.
You did not, which you didn't even believe was happening.
I did not believe. No.
And then once you got hired, I was like, there's more for her.
Yeah.
You ended up becoming White House social secretary within what, like three years of being an intern?
Yeah, well, it was 4 years of being an intern. Yeah. And
okay.
I mean, and to be clear, like, I didn't know. I was like, I don't know how this all works. Like, I don't know what I'm doing. But like the foundations of like, I know how to like show up to work. I know how to work hard. I'm gonna learn. That was really like the core of it. Like, there was no political anything on my resume. But I was like, hey, like, I'm here for the same reasons, you know, Barack Obama ran, like, to make everything better. Like, I was a community organizer to bring people in. So I was like, we like have the same vibe. Like, and so once I got into like the White House, I was like, oh, like, I'm in this department where I was like, I feel like we had the best department. So I was like, this is the best department.
We really did.
I don't care what people say. We really did.
And you want to know why we had the best department? Because I don't think I looked at people's resumes really. I wanted to see who they were as people. And by the way, I think every single person who has ever worked for me had customer service experience, which I believe is clutch.
Yes.
Constituents are customers.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you can't, and in our department, if you're going to a town where we're bringing the president and we need people's help to put it in like events together, well, they're customers. We want to treat them and have them leaving. Like, I don't know if you remember, but because we were such nerds, our tagline, our like team motto was like, leave it better than you found it.
Yeah.
Like, go into a community and leave it better than you found it. But like, Deesh, you did all of this. And the wildest thing I think about your book is that as extremely successful and beloved and respected as you were in both the East and West Wing, which is not easy because we all know Mama Obama was tough on West Wingers.
Yes.
And you write in the book about imposter syndrome, 100%. Which is also something I experienced, but you wrote about much more eloquently. How has imposter syndrome manifested in your life?
Yeah, you know, the thing is I always tell people, like, I did all of that. And that's why I was so honest in the book, because I'm like, your accomplishments and achievements are wonderful and amazing and super dope. But at the end of the day, like, you have to keep doing them to feel like a high of validation and worthiness.
Right.
And I'm like, I was like addicted to that. And so for me, imposter syndrome started when I was young. Like, I went to a boarding school and like was told, like, you're loud, like, you're too bold, your attitude sucks. So all of these things I was told, I believe them throughout like high school, throughout like my first job, throughout dropping out of college. And so I definitely was just like, I'm just like a fluke. Like, it's a fluke that I'm here at the White House. Like, they must have just like literally like not found anybody else. And now to say that sounds so ridiculous, because like, who did not want to work there, right? But like, that's literally what I thought. And I was like, they have no other people to take this job. And so like, or they're going to find out, like I always say in the book about interviewing with you, like, Alyssa, I don't have a college degree. It's just so we're very clear. So you can just like hang up the phone now, go back to your life, enjoy yourself. Thank you.
And
that was not
your
answer.
That
was not your answer. And it was just like, for me, I try to tell people, like, imposter syndrome, like, it made a home in my body. Like, it was like, I'm your best friend sitting down having a drink. And I didn't even recognize like that it was a bad thing, because I was like, this is my friend. Like, this is like my clutch. This is like my security blanket. Until like, number one, people started, like, young people would look at me and be like, you're so confident. You're so amazing. And I'm sure you got that too, and you'd be like, what are you talking about? Like, you're not.
Like, I'm a government employee. That's all I ever felt.
Yeah, I'm just like, I'm not, like, what are you talking about? And so I started to realize that, like, I needed to get it together. And I think that once it started affecting, like, my mental health and physical health, I was like, I'm like legit like this. It's going to kill me. Like I need to like get my shit together. And so I think that that is like really when I like tame the beast of being like, let me go to therapy. Let me dig up these roots and like throw them away. And now I'm so thankful because I'm on the other side and like it still pops up like obviously like, you know, but at the same time, it like it's like a guest that like comes to the door and I'm like, no, thank you. Like, you know, somebody trying to sell you shit like no, thank you. And then they bounce versus like coming in and having dinner. So that's how it always is. Describe it.
Yes, that is the best way to describe it because like also you and I are people who have since we left the White House done things that aren't really adjacent. You know, like we're not political consultants. Right. It's not, you know, we don't do that. And so every time I do something new, I mean, my first week when I was when I started working at Bed by Eight, my production company with George Stephanopoulos and Ali Wentworth, my first Zoom with 20th Century, which is where we have the where the pod is. I came so prepared. I wrote the longest memo. I was like, I just don't want them to think I'm a fraud. Yes. I mean, like, even still. And then literally they had to be like, girl, can you take it from a 10 to a 5? You're good. And I was like, okay. But Deesh, you have actually gone on. You, mentorship has played a huge part of your life. And so you've always been a mentor. What does it mean to you now that you've identified and sort of self-treated for imposter syndrome? What does it mean? Like, what does meeting you mean to young girls now that you have tended to yourself?
You know, it's so interesting, Alyssa, because I'm still just like, I'm still Deesha from Philly. Like, I'm still this regular person. And these young people, like these young girls, especially young Black girls, they're just like, your book, like, I felt so seen. I felt so like heard. I felt like I had a friend. And to me, like being honest about it, like, I'm not going to like give you bullet point. Like, I'm not going to do that because like, it's hard. Like, it's hard work to like kind of get over all these things that you've always been told about yourself as a woman, as somebody who's Black, as like whatever. And so now my reframing is just like they are literally looking at me and like I don't want to look in the mirror and be like, you know, I'm saying one thing but feeling another. So I have to get this treated. But I also am super careful that I'm not like at the end of the book, I got married. I'm so happy. Everything's great. I'm like, no, like I actually applied for a job after the White House that I really wanted and didn't get it. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I'm just like, let me be honest that it still shows up, right? And so I think that being with these young women, like they just, and they gravitate towards me. And I think part of it is because like, I'm so real about how I talk about it. And I'm just like, yeah, I don't let it control me anymore, but I'm not going to lie to you and be like, I got the social secretary position. So like, I was on top of the world. I was just like, oh my God, this hair is out of place. Oh my God, they're going to fire me for a nose ring. Oh my God, like my nail isn't done. Like it was every little thing. And like now, like when I talk to Ms. Obama, she's like, Deesha, like we always, like you were always great. You know what I mean? Like we never. Like,
it is, that was, you know. Once you leave and go back, it is a shocking, like when you get a little distance from your life. So I had not thought about this in a long time, but when I was reading your book for like the fifth time, because I've been reading it since there were galleys, I was like, what was my first, because my like real moment of imposter syndrome was when I became deputy chief of staff. Because President Obama was like, yeah, like you're doing this. And I went to our boss, Pete Rouse, and I was like, here's a list of five people I think could do it better. And Pete was like, God damn it. You're the only person who thinks you can't do this. Shut the fuck up and take the job. Like, you know, Pete Rouse, you know, that's how he talked. That is how he talked.
And that'd be the end of the conversation.
That was it. Literally looked at me like, there's the door, you've annoyed me, go. And I was like, okay, fine. So the first week I took over, I was at David Axelrod's going away party, and the Situation Room called me and they were like, ma'am, we have to evacuate American citizens, AMCITs, from Cairo. And I was like, why? And they're like, Hosni Mubarak is being deposed. And I was like, what do I have to do with that? They're like, you have to evacuate them. And I was like, cool. I'll be in. Like, is that what's happening? I'll be in. Literally walked into the sit room and was like, okay, gonna be honest. Don't know how to evacuate people. Can we like get a primer going here? And you know what? I also found that not being a big swinging dick and pretending like you knew what to do actually got you much further, because they were like, okay, this nice lady in the Care Bear sweater is really, she's trying. So we're gonna help her out. So got all those folks from Illinois out. What was, do you remember your first big social event that you you had to produce?
I mean, Alyssa, it was definitely the Pope. And it's so funny when you tell that story.
Ah, like, I thought it was the Pope.
I could see your face actually when you were doing that. That's hilarious. But I would say the Pope because Jeremy Bernard, who is the first openly gay male in the role, was my predecessor. And he was like, you know, I'm going to be leaving, blah, blah. And I was thinking, okay, like, you know, leaving like later in the year, you know, like, okay, we have time. And he's like, oh no, I'm leaving in May. And I'm like, well, the Pope comes in September. And he was like, yeah. And I'm like, wait a minute. I'm not Catholic. I don't go, what do I need to do? Do we got church? I mean, I was so lost when they were just like, you're in charge and you've been in a room with like Secret Service and White House communications and military office. And they're all looking at all these dudes are just staring at you. And you're like, and they're just like, okay, ma'am. So we're going to start the planning. I was like, okay, like, you know, and thankfully,
like, let me know how it goes.
Like, you know, like, let me know like what you need. Like, you know, I got you. And thankfully for me, like the social secretaries are such a tight knit community. Like I called Capricia Marshall, Clinton's social secretary. And I was like, Capricia, what am I supposed to be doing here? And she's like, Deisha, she was like, there are papers from when the Pope came during our, and I'm like, great. So I found that and I just started doing these meetings. But again, they were basically like organizing meetings of like, do you have like your shit together? Like, do you have this? Like, you're in charge of this. You're in charge of this. And then I would brief the Obamas and be like, you know, what kind of music would you like? And they're like, well, whatever you like. And I'm like, this is like, I don't make the decisions.
They were always very solicitous of stuff like that.
Yes.
Like when we were doing the second inauguration, it had to be the second.
Mm-hmm.
POTUS Obama was like, well, who would you like to see? And I was like, can we have Kelly Clarkson? And he's like, if you want to have Kelly Clarkson, let's have Kelly Clarkson. I was like, oh my God. And then I saw her in the bathroom and I wanted to tell her that like, I was like, I want to tell Kelly Clarkson that she was my pitch. And then I was like, no, it means more to her. Like they loved her and they were into it. And I was just like then too nervous to talk to her. And I was just like, never mind.
Yeah.
But that is, they were very wonderful
so
and warm
wonderful.
About wanting to hear what we thought because they knew what they liked, but we were like a little younger, like not much, but a little.
Well, I think the other thing about it was too, is that like I was at the end. So being the last social secretary, it was like balls to the wall. Like
zero fucks dire.
Whatever we're doing, I'd be like, we're going to bring in a DJ. Great. We're going to do this? That sounds great. We're going to bring a whole marching band? They're like, we don't know how this is going to work, but we trust you. And I'm like, this is nuts. So I'd say the Pope was like definitely my like, what the hell?
Well, and also for you, the one thing, and I want this to be like the ultimate compliment, is that when Michelle Obama became first lady, her number one priority was making the White House accessible to people who weren't like the elite political ivory tower people.
Yeah.
And that really was your, almost more than any other social secretary, that was like in your DNA.
Oh, yeah. 100%.
Like you put together the most like community inspired events and made sure the guest lists were always super dynamic and people who just weren't, you know, assumed to be joining, you know?
Yeah, 100%. We had formerly incarcerated people.
I know you did.
I mean, we were just like, so I was like, everybody should come in here. Like, I was not, like, I'm not opening the door. I, like, took off the hinges. I was like, this is, like, who is available? Like, that we having a party? Like, who back home? Who wherever? And that was, like, my joy. And you know, like, seeing people come to the White House was, like, when Barack Obama was, it was, like, they had hit like the lottery. They just, their mouths were so open. And it just was like, it was the best feeling. It was like, that's what I probably missed the most, the people and like the access of like being able to give that gift to people. That's like what I miss the most. Yeah.
This, I agree. And so here's an interesting question that I have always been asked. Everyone always asks me, like, what am I most proud of? Like, Alyssa, what are you most proud of in the White House? And, you know, it didn't actually hit me until after we left. A dear friend of ours, Brandon Lipo, was very sick. And we all got an email that said, treatment's not working. Mm-hmm. He's in Houston.
Mm-hmm.
And, Deisha, I can't even tell this without crying.
Yeah.
The thing that I looked back on in my life and was like, I did something fucking good, is when that email went out to about 15 people, within 48 hours, about 60 people had flown and shown up in Houston. You were there. All of, like, it was, And it sounds really sad, but it was like the most joyous, celebratory, weird reunion. People were texting. It's like, who's got the beer? Who's got the barbecue? Mm-hmm. And like, I think that the thing I was most proud of is that I built a team that extended and lives long past the 18 acres of the White House campus. 100%. What is the thing you were most proud of?
Yeah, I think, and to talk about that, I remember it too. It gives me chills because I remember we had friends who just had a baby. Grant and Julie had just had their baby. And they brought they brought the baby, and we were all in, like, we took over the waiting room. I will never forget that. And it's like, what are you getting for dinner? And like, we're just like Chinese, like pizza, whatever. And like, we're all just like hanging out, being able to take turns and go and see Brandon. I remember that. But I think I would say probably the number of young women that I have put through, like the same thing that happened to me, like through the internship program that rose to the White House, that are currently in the current White House or in different leadership positions. I think that I was like, if I'm in a position to be able to bring people in, I want to do like what Alyssa and Danielle did for me. Like, I want to make sure that, like, of course, there's a place for people who are pedigreed. Of course, right? They're going to get their love. Like, move on.
Yeah.
But like, I was like, I'm going to find these people, and to see the trajectory of some of these women, especially that I put through, is just like, I mean, they are just like running their own businesses or like
it's amazing
at places. And I'm just like, number one, I'm like, hire me. Then number two, I'm like, don't like look at this lineage of like the legacy that we left. Like, you know, like by living in Barack Obama's legacy. And till this day, like, I still get things like, I remember you. Remember you came and talked to me as an intern and you told me not to give up and wrote a letter for me. And I'm just like, I the legacy, I think, and that I was able to be able to, like, you know, kind of get the catalyst of that was just everything to me still.
Okay, so Deesh, this is last question. So you and I, about the same age.
Yes.
And I would like to think of this as my second act. I hope I have many acts. Mm-hmm. But what do you wish for yourself in this next act of life?
Alyssa, I would like to move overseas. That's my dream.
Move
overseas and live one of these, like, Copenhagen, Denmark lives where, like, you're, like, seeing me on my bike with a Danish, like, every day, not caring about...
I want tulips in that basket.
Not caring about anything. I would, like... And I'll work. Don't get me wrong. Like, I'll work.
We'll always have to work.
But
that's
like,
who we are.
But, like, I so bad... Like, I was actually going to move overseas when COVID hit. Like, I so bad want to live, like, in Europe or Spain or Africa, someplace that I can just, like, breathe for a second and see what it's like to, like, just go somewhere and be completely thrown out of my element. Like, I'm constantly, like, being like, are there overseas opportunities somewhere? Like, I am so into it, it's ridiculous. And so that's like my next act, I hope, is like getting out of here.
Okay.
After the election, getting out of here.
I love that for you.
Yes.
Deesh, thank you so much for joining the pod this week.
Yes.
Everyone go buy her book, Undiplomatic. It's currently available wherever you get your books. When we come back, Erin is back for Sani Petty.
Hi, my name is Mitch Landrieu.
My name is Erin Haynes.
My name is Jennifer Palmieri, and we're hosting a new series called Long Play. The South is the new political epicenter of the country. Democrats are way on their heels in this region, but Republicans are going through their own reckoning in the South, too.
I mean, the South has always shaped American politics. We know that.
The stakes could not be higher, but to win the South, you have to understand it.
People in the South feel really misunderstood, left behind, put down on, and they want to explain that to somebody.
We're traveling across 6 southern states to explore the people, the issues, the assumptions that no longer hold, and what the rest of us are missing about a region that will shape the future of our politics and our country. From Left, Right, and Crooked Media, starting July 27th, watch Long Play series on YouTube at youtube.com/longplayseries or listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, my name is Mitch Landrieu.
My name is Erin Haynes.
My name is Jennifer Palmieri, and we're hosting a new series called Long Play. The South is the new political epicenter of the country.
Democrats are way on their heels in this region, but Republicans are going through their own reckoning in the South, too.
I mean, the South has always shaped American politics. We know that.
The stakes could not be higher, but to win the South, you have to understand it.
People in the South feel really misunderstood, left behind, put down on, and they want to explain that to somebody.
We're traveling across 6 Southern states to explore the people, the issues, the assumptions that no longer hold, and what the rest of us are missing about a region that will shape the future of our politics and our country. From Left, Right, and Crooked Media, starting July 27th, watch Long Play Series on YouTube at youtube.com/longplayseries or listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Hysteria, the podcast for people thrilled about berry season. I am thrilled for berry season. I can't get enough. I have 3 pots of berries on my stove right now. Before we get to Sani Petty, we've got announcements for the class. Pride Month is here and the Crooked Store is stocked with merch to help you celebrate. Whether you're full of joy, rage, or cheap tequila, this Pride Month, there's something for you in the Pride or Else collection. I've been loving my friend of a friend of Dorothy tea. True, was wearing it just the other day. Plus, our best-selling Leave Trans Kids Alone, You Absolute Freaks merch is back with totally new designs and styles because, unfortunately, the freaks are still acting up. A portion of proceeds from every order go to Crooked's Pride or Else Fund in support of organizations working to provide gender-affirming care and life-saving resources to queer and transgender communities across America. Check out the whole collection at crooked.com/store. Okay, announcements have been announced. Erin, I am petty this week, but I think you may be petty enough for both of us. Erin, what are you feeling petty about?
Honestly, I am feeling petty about this ongoing storyline that, you know, Black voters, particularly Black men, are suddenly about to abandon the Democratic Party en masse because they are so enamored with former President Trump's appeal to them. He certainly is making an effort. He was in Detroit just last week. He's going to be back in Philadelphia, where I live, later this week. The idea that we're about to see some kind of overwhelming exodus for Trump with Black voters is really make it make sense. I'm not. I don't know where this is coming from. I don't know how real that is. I mean, certainly, you know, President Biden's got to shore up support with Black voters. P.S. Right. Like, you know, candidates campaign for voters. Like, that's how elections work. Even though we talk about the overwhelming support from the Black community for the Democratic Party, like, they still have to work for those voters. And I think that, you know, that is what needs to happen, certainly over the next 5 months if he, you know, plans to be reelected. But the idea that these folks, just because those numbers may be lagging right now, that those folks are automatically, you know, going to be voting for former President Trump. It's just not real. Also, I mean, I don't know if you saw that kind of roundtable in Detroit at the Black church that was full of white voters,
white people.
Like, I mean, this is kind of how you understand that narrative is not, it's not adding up. It's just not adding up. Like, why are these white people at this Black church at a you know, Black voter event? Or, you know, the story that was just in Semaphore earlier this week with, you know, 80s era kind of Black sports icons, Daryl Strawberry, Don King, Lawrence Taylor, making the case for Trump. Like, these people are not a proxy for, you know, Black people in America. Absolutely. No, that's not real. I don't know why this narrative is, it's persisting because it's interesting. And if it were actually true,
of course,
it would be fascinating. But
And also in one of the polls, I looked at a little cross tabby, and which I only do on occasion because I'm not a poll. I don't really believe in polls or focus groups, whatever. It's like it's always a cherry pick group of people. But one of the things that I was like, wait a minute. I'm not the smartest person in America, but I got a problem with this one. So one of the questions was they asked Black men if they were more likely or less likely to vote for Donald Trump as president now that he was convicted. Mm. And not a lot of people said less likely. Well, But they didn't ask them if they were planning on voting for him in the first place. So if you were voting for Biden and Trump got convicted, you wouldn't be less likely because you were never voting for him in the first place. And so I was like, this is sus. I don't like this. Like, why? See, and that's when I'm like, and it's like, you know, from 6 to 8 p.m., it's all that was on the news. Like, this is why I wanted you to talk about this, because it's like, no.
Yeah, see, like, this is why nobody calls me to ask me poll questions for elections, because I would have very much, I reject the premise of the question. Like, what are you doing?
Exactly. Yeah. It is not correct. So anyway, listeners, take all this shit with a grain of salt and, you know, look at the crosstabs occasionally. See if they're asking all the questions and how they're asking the questions.
Yeah, very, very interesting things in the crosstabs, people.
Very interesting things. So that's it for this week. Thank you to Disha Dyer for joining. Erin, thank you so much for being my co-host this week. We have a special guest joining next week, but Erin's coming back with us in 2 weeks. So much great stuff is coming up. As always, if you have any comments, ideas, or news items for us to see, email us at hysteria@crooked.com. We'll see you next week for more Hysteria.
Don't forget to follow us at Crooked Media on IG, Twitter, and TikTok. Subscribe to Hysteria on YouTube for access to video versions of your favorite segments and other exclusive content. And if you're as opinionated as we are, consider dropping us a nice review. Hysteria is a Crooked Media production. Caroline Reston is our senior producer. Our executive producer is me, Erin Ryan. And Alyssa Mastromonaco is our co-producer. Fiona Pestana is our associate producer. The show is engineered and edited by Jordan Cantor. We get audio support from Kyle Seglin and Charlotte Landis. Our video producers are Rachel Gajewski and Megan Patzel. And thank you to Julia Beach, Ewa Okolate, Adia Hill, and David Tolles for production support every week.
Hi, my name is Mitch Landrieu.
My name is Erin Haynes.
My name is Jennifer Palmieri, and we're hosting a new series called Long Play. The South is the new political epicenter of the country. Democrats are way on their heels in this region, but Republicans are going through their own reckoning in the South, too.
I mean, the South has always shaped American politics. We know that.
The stakes could not be higher, but to win the South, you have to understand it.
People in the South feel really misunderstood, left behind, put down on, and they want to explain that to somebody.
We're traveling across 6 Southern states to explore the people, the issues, the assumptions that no longer hold, and what the rest of us are missing about a region that will shape the future of our politics and our country. From Left, Right, and Crooked Media, starting July 27th. Watch Long Play series on YouTube at youtube.com/longplayseries or listen wherever you get your podcasts.